Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. We're going to get right into it this week. This is part two of my discussion with Kevin and Anya. The murder sheet on the Delphi case last week, we got through the timeline and the firearms analysis. And today we've got about 40 minutes. Kevin and Anya have a hard out, so we're going to try to buzz through it pretty quick. But we're going to talk about Richard Allen's confessions, Judge Gall, and anything else that we can squeeze in the next 39 minutes. So Kevin and Anya, thanks for coming back.
We got this. Thank you so much for having us,
Bob. Really appreciate it.
Yep. So I'll just turn right over to you guys. You guys had talked about your feelings and we kind of went back and forth on the first two kind of elements of the case you wanted to discuss. So let's talk about the Richard Allen confessions.
Yeah. So the Richard Allen confessions are, you know, I think the third prong of this. And I think, you know, they're multifaceted. I think some of them are really more accurately described as incriminating statements versus straight up confessions. Some are confessions. Many are very vague. I think the one I want to focus on that I think was a big game changer for myself personally is the most detailed confession he gave, in which he kind of outlined his story of what happened that day and also provided a detail that we feel only the killer could have known about. And that, you know, to me, this was a very big deal as far as the jury was concerned and as far as our own viewpoint on his guilt. Because I think a lot of other things in the case, you can maybe say there are two sides to it, or you could maybe say, well, you can't just convict based on that. But this is, to me, a bit of a keystone as far as just everything kind of hanging together. So I'll talk about that one. He confesses to his prison psychologist, Dr. Monica Walla, that he is, you know, he goes out there. He starts the day at his parents' house in Mexico, Indiana, has a, you know, nice brunch breakfast with them. Leaves, goes to the trails, and as he describes it, you know, he's drank some beer that day, drank part of a six pack, and is wanting to find a female, either a girl or a woman to rape. And that's, I believe that's something he fantasized about for many, many years, but today he acted upon it. And he encounters the girls, but he thinks, you know, he basically sees this opportunity where they're crossing the bridge and he's able to cut them off. But he indicates that he didn't know that they were that young. He thought they were 19. When you look at them, I don't buy that. But that's what he says. In his telling, he pulls out a gun, forces them down the hill. And this is, you know, with the intent to rape them. But what he says that I think is truly the significant detail that kind of clinches it for me, at least, is he is startled when, to give you a sense of the geography, beneath the bridge, I believe it's running under the bridge at some point, there is an access road that leads to, you know, kind of, it's almost like a private driveway for this house where, you know, people live out there. It's not a road where you're seeing a lot of cars. Therefore, it's kind of like, how do you get to these people's house, the Webbers? And he sees a white van going down that road. He basically, you know, panics at that point and decides to kill them. So it's almost like, oh my God, like it's almost like he sees this car where he's not expecting to see a car. And it's like, I need to get like whatever my fantasy was for what's happening here. I need to get this like wrapped up and get rid of the witnesses here in his telling. So why is the white van important? Well, here's why it's important. The white van is a detail that police were able to later confirm. They were able to go to Brad Weber, who is a witness in the case. They were able to find texts where he's going back and forth with someone saying, hey, I'll basically have something hitched that I can bring to you. The only vehicle he has that can has that capability is the white van. And it's that for that day. And they also have Brad Weber's timestamps, or rather his when he clocked in and out of work that day at Subaru. And they're able to essentially say, you know, if he's clocking out at this time, traffic patterns that day, he would have likely been rolling down that drive around the time where this is happening. And Richard Allen knows this somehow, even though this is not even in the discovery. This is not even in the files. Like they run this down after he makes this statement. They say like, okay, well, were you driving a white van that day? How can we confirm or disprove that? And the defense's counter is, well, other white vans came up in other places in this case, but that doesn't matter because, you know, they're talking about things that were like on social media. Like, I saw a creepy white van in Logansport that day. Who cares? You know,
and what matters is at the time Richard Allen made this confession, placing a white van at the crime scene while the crime was occurring. No one knew a white van was at the crime scene while the crime was occurring. There was nothing on social media about that. The police didn't even have that information. When he said this to Dr. Walla, he was the only person in the world who had that information, and it was later confirmed by investigators.
No one could have planted that in his mind.
Okay, so that I'm going to throw it in. I'll leave it to the listeners to fact check any of this stuff because I don't even know I have the resources to do it, but you guys were there, but I'll pose it to you. The white van thing, I've heard all kinds of different explanations about it. I don't know what's accurate and what's not accurate. I've heard a lot about timeline issues with like a surveillance camera or something. Wasn't there like a camera where the time was off on it, so they weren't able to, you know, I remember that from trial. There was argument about that. But then one thing that I've heard repeatedly, and I don't know if it was true, it sounds like not, or at least from what you guys are saying or not, was that the white van interrupting the crime was a theory that was being discussed on Facebook or Reddit or somewhere in a group that Monica Walla was a part of. That was something that I've heard over and over again, that like that was a detail that she was part of or in a group where these discussions about this white van were happening prior to the confession. Is there any truth to that?
So I know there's truth to it in the sense that Dr. Walla was part of, I think, a couple of groups around podcasts or YouTubes that were interested in the case.
And I've also seen indications that people on Facebook who may have gotten leaks from people involved in the investigation may have made references to this white van incident online. But those references were made after he made the confession and after the investigators had made the link.
Yeah. So to me, no, I don't think that's accurate. And I also would say that, you know, the idea that the prison psychologist, who I want to be very clear, is a woman who doesn't want to hear any of his confessions, like keeps telling him, talk to your lawyers. Like, no one in prison wants to hear his confessions. Like, the warden doesn't even come to the man's cell when he writes him something saying, come and hear my confessions, basically. Like, everyone does not want to be embroiled in this. The idea that she's some kind of jumped up sleuth is kind of stupid. And it's since come out that, like, she told her supervisors she was interested in the case. Like, it wasn't a situation where she was hiding that. I feel like that's overstated.
I also think it's worth noting that if you heard this woman testify and got some of these details, I think it's arguable of all the people in the prison system, the legal system, she may have been the one that cared about this man the most. She was like giving him books on how to preserve your spirit in prison. She was advocating for his wife to visit. She thought his window was all scratched up. Let's get him a new window so he could look outside.
She was telling him he had fans online.
She was telling him there's people out there who believe in you. So she's trying to buck him up and support him. It's not like she was some undercover person trying to get him to confess.
I will say, you mentioned this timestamp issue, and I'm glad you brought that up. So that did not come out at trial. That came up after trial where the defense, in sort of a last-ditch effort, like they had that information, and they could have brought it up at trial had they wanted to. But I think they didn't, for a reason I will tell you. they brought it up later in a motion to correct errors, I believe. And they're saying, oh, this timestamp on the video shows that Brad Weber in his white van would have been getting there like later. I forget what the discrepancy was. If it was
like maybe 5 minutes,
I thought it was
minutes,
15 minutes or something like within there. Like, oh, he came too,
because there
late.
Was also there were in his initial statement, he had said that he was stopping to serve as an ATM or something.
Well, that was okay. Well, that was the one, you know, you mentioned the Doolin thing not being recorded. That was the interview he did with FBI, who, of course, do not record their interviews. Typically, mm-hmm. they're usually doing a 302, just writing it down. He denies that he said that. They had a guy on the stand who was present at that interview. He didn't remember that. So to me, Weber was very consistent, except for this one interview that's not recorded. And they were able mm-hmm. to impeach him on that. They were able to say, well, you said in this, and he's saying, I didn't say that. Like, so they were able to hash that out at trial. The timestamp issue, I think they didn't bring up in trial because basically, like, there was no confirmation that that timestamp was accurate. We're doing the Jared Bridegain case right now. You actually see this quite a bit. There's a power outage, something happens, and then the timestamp's off. What that video did seem to show, though, was a white van going down that road at around that time, and that they can't exactly be sure about the timestamp on it. But that doesn't really look good for him at that point, that you have right. the white van there at all. And if it's 15 minutes off, or if it's 15 minutes late or early or whatever, like, I could imagine why they would not want the jury to see that, because that's risky. And if the prosecution's able to raise, well, yeah, we don't know the exact timestamp, but this pretty much like,
because at trial, they were trying to suggest, well, we're not even sure he drove a white van by at all.
No. You know, so I think that they wanted to just forget the white van. And then like then when,
right.
you know,
that but yeah, from a strategy standpoint, I agree. That would be it's a double edged. It probably was strategically it's probably better to do it this way because the prosecution kind of leaned on this, what, 232 time. They let that settle. And then came back and said, well, they said it was over by 2:32 and we have evidence that the van didn't go by till 2:50 or whatever.
Yeah. And I think it the whole thing, I think this white van thing definitely was devastating for Alan, that he was able to pinpoint that, something that, again, was just not in the mix even for law enforcement. I think that was shocking to a lot of people.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Again, I'll have to do some research on that. Because that was one of the things, when I was listening to the confessions, all the recordings of them, as I'm going through them one after another, I'm just like, this means nothing, you know, him in this mental state saying, I think I did it. What if I did it? What if, you know, when I worked with Jim Tranum and Stan Burke, you know, they were a confession has, it's a story. It is as a beginning, a middle, an end. You're telling me details, things that only the killer could know. And like, none of those had that. They're just, you know, there's utterances of whatever. It could mean anything. And then when I heard that confession, the one you're talking about, I'm like, okay, now we have, like, now there's a narrative here that we can look at. This is a actual confession worth looking into. I had some concerns, which, you know, again, that goes back to what you hear on the tape, because it was like, well, there were indications to me that would make me wonder if something was, you know,
I don't know if this one
him.
Was recorded, I will say. I think this is maybe, are we mostly
Oh, that's the one she wrote.
Dr. Wall's notes. You know, I think he was bringing her in because he, like, his wife was kind of, you know, drawing away from him, mm-hmm. I believe. And so I think he wanted another woman to kind of be his support.
Yeah, you're refreshing my, yeah, because when I listened to them all, I'm like, those aren't even, like, that's nothing to me.
Yeah, but I think most of the stuff we heard was him talking to his wife, which I also want to note that, like, I don't believe that this man was psychotic. I believe he was malingering. I think when we hear about, like, we heard from the testimony of prison guards, we've heard from the testimony of the mental health professionals there. I think he's a highly manipulative person. I think his conversations with his wife, I mean, just stand out to me, regardless of whether you think, I mean, I don't I don't necessarily put a lot of stock into anything that's not a detailed confession either. But I think he's trying to basically grapple her into saying, I still love you anyway. Like, it's very, like, their dynamic is messed up, man. Like, but I, beyond that, that doesn't make him guilty, but I'm just saying that.
Well, I'm curious what you said that you don't think he was psychotic. Because didn't,
no, yeah.
Didn't Dr. Walla, didn't she diagnose him as being psychotic?
At some point, they basically, they had a determination with the mental health staff there that, hey, it doesn't matter if he's psychotic because he's self-harming. You know, he's eating his own feces, which is something, again, like people do weird stuff in prison to have a semblance of control. That's not unheard of if you talk to prison guards. But, you know, they felt that at this point, he's a danger to himself, regardless of whether he's faking this or regardless of whether he's telling the truth. They had their own mental health experts who talked about why they felt he was psychotic. The state had people on to, you know, the defense put on an expert who was one of the Westville people who were, you know, I think a psychologist who was overseeing his treatment. She ended up being devastating for the defense because they were just asking her, so what does psychosis look like? And she's describing all of these different things. And it was none of what we were seeing from Richard Allen. You know,
I was just thinking, I swear I remember when I was going through this part of the trial reading where Walla either through her notes and diagnosis or from the stand that she's diagnosed him as being in a state of psychosis.
I don't know. I think she said she was open to it. I mean, I think she said like now I think maybe he was. But at the time when they're doing this, there were other people who were saying we believe he's malingering because he would be very in control of his actions. For instance, like the defense would say, oh, he wasn't eating. But he would take these kind of fasting breaks for long enough to not trip up the hunger strike thing. So he'd like, if 4 days without eating makes you go on hunger strike watch, he'd just do it for 3 days. He would be waiting for people to come watch him before he started acting in a way that was erratic or wild and stop when he was no longer being paid attention to. He would be very calm to the extent of kind of just trying to explain himself to his wife and mother on these calls. He's not saying, well, then King Charlemagne told me this, and then I was talking to Jesus. Like for many of these things, he's extremely calm. And again, I think psychosis can manifest itself in different ways. But what we were hearing again and again from a lot of people who were interacting with him in prison was a lot of his most erratic behavior would come on the heels of him meeting with his legal defense team. They felt like he was faking it. And I think, seeing how manipulative he is and knowing how he was before all of this happened, I think he was faking it to get sympathy and attention and to try to force his wife to continue loving and supporting him no matter what. I don't buy the psychosis thing at all. I don't think they confirm that. I'll tell you, the jury saw a lot more than we did because they got to see the videos of him. And when we talked to them, they were disgusted with him. They felt that it was attention seeking. They just felt like the whole thing was a ploy to get out of what he had done.
Sure. So the more, I guess, critical part of this is going back to what you said. Once we got to the confession, when there was seemingly a detail that was given that was guilty knowledge, something only the killer could know. Yeah. So when I heard that, and I guess it was her testimony about or notes about him confessing to her, I was skeptical when I heard someone who carries a gun, owns a gun, carries it around all the time, that she says he says he did something with the gun and something came out. That didn't seem like something that Richard Allen would say, because I think he would say, I racked the gun, I did whatever, you know what I mean? And
I think
it's possible.
He only took it while fishing or mushroom hunting. He wasn't concealed carrying.
But he's familiar enough with gun. I mean, anybody familiar with a gun is, you're not gonna, you know, I'm not a gun enthusiast. I own guns, but I would never say I did something to
but
the
Bob,
gun.
But
you
Bob, you're
know
an articulate
I mean?
Man. I don't think he really is.
Well, thank you.
I mean, you wouldn't.
Yeah. But yeah, that was a little weird to me. And then the fact that he said it happened up on the bridge when the bullet was actually found down by the, because as if that was the case, you know, and I think what you mentioned this in last week's episode where you had said something that, you know, there's a different, what you were talking about as far as how that could have played out would have been if there wasn't one in the chamber, right? So the magazine's in the gun, but it's not chambered. And if by the bridge he racked it, that would have racked one into the chamber, would not have ejected a shell.
Yeah.
And then down at the crime scene, if they racked it again, then one came out. My personal, which is a whole longer discussion than we have time for now, on the video. I don't think that they were forced down at gunpoint. It was my personal opinion on that. And that's just an opinion. That's why it's not worth having a long discussion about it now. But kind of my conclusion that I kind of came to was that they had an interaction with this creepy guy that he had maybe told them he wanted when they got to the other side of the bridge. I want to show you something over there. They didn't want to go, but you know, two young girls with an authority, you know, an adult figure, they just kind of went along with it. That was the impression I got from it, was that when he came and he said, guys, you know, she's like, oh, there's no path over here. Can't go this way. And then he says, guys, down the hill. And they just go, was that the impression I got was that they'd already had an interaction with him. They were planning on going somewhere with him, but they didn't want to. Anyway, back to the, I'm digressing all over the place after I said we got a tight time window here. But the white van thing to me, and that's something I'll need to look in more on, because again, my impression of it is based around the fact that I have heard and not seen with my own eyes, or verified with my own eyes, that Dr. Walla had been exposed to that theory prior to this in these other four. Do you guys feel like I just need to see. Because if she didn't know, then it's extremely significant.
I don't think she did, because I don't think that was out there. And I just want to say, I'd want to see a screenshot of someone, you know, talking about that with her, because I just don't think that exists.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
I was going to ask you guys, you were the first people that I've talked to that seemed to be comfortable with Monica Wall. Did you find her, like, any of the stuff that she was doing as far as, like, her involvement with the case, her being involved in the social media groups? Didn't she end up getting fired from the prison because of lying about something regarding the case? Like, did you find her problematic at all, or you just think she's just fine?
At first I did. And then when I learned more context, she was not fired from the, so she didn't work for the prison directly. She was working for a contractor that services the prison. I think she was just transferred into something else because they didn't like the publicity for this. I think the defense crucified her. And I think she was probably just trying to do the right thing. The thing I found off-putting was, I think she was overly sympathetic with her patient. I think she's overly sympathetic with Richard Allen. And I think, I think that came back to bite her. I think that she, certain things that they made a big deal about, like she was researching something with the case. At first, that sounded really bad to me. But then when we got more details, it just seemed kind of like she had made her supervisors aware of her interest. And then I think, wanted to look. I mean, it just didn't end up sounding like the biggest deal in the world. I think the defense wanted her, on one hand, to be liked by the jury so she could describe what a hard time he was having so they could be sympathetic to Allen. But on the other hand, then they would crucify her over, you know, basically being the person he confessed to. And from what I could tell, she did not want to hear the confessions. She kept on telling him, talk to your legal team. Don't give this to me. And I feel like she has gotten undue criticism, although I can't say that she did everything perfectly. I think the thing I found off-putting was maybe the over. She was really trying to make this guy happy.
It seems like maybe there's like a kind of going back to the term you were using earlier, like the totality of it, where like maybe those things weren't that, but it's unfortunate that the one detailed confession that contains an element that could actually prove guilty knowledge came from only from her, who then has these other little things, you know, she was interested in the case and she was researching the case and stuff. It's like, you would, in a perfect world, you would hope that wasn't the case, right? That the confession would come from a very clean source.
Exactly.
And not from a source from somebody who is, you know, researching the case outside of it.
Well, we do what we have, unfortunately. Yeah. But I agree. I mean, like, it's unfortunate. A lot of this stuff is like, well, if it happened in a cleaner way, then people wouldn't question it. But I think people just have to recognize, like, life is messy. And he saw her as a person who sympathized with him. So I think he felt comfortable spilling his guts with her.
Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
We can talk a little bit about the gull side of it all, because I think that was
let's hear that.
And that's something, like, Kevin and I feel like if somebody is guilty and they get railroaded in court, like they need a new trial. You know what I mean? Like that's, I don't, like if we felt this trial had been unfair, we would certainly feel like, yeah, that's.
And I'll even go so far to say, I'm sure this will make me sound petty, I'm not a huge fan of Judge Gulk. Not only did she deny us a press pass because we're just merely podcasters.
That's right.
At one point, she in an email says that maybe Anya and Kevin should be thrown in jail. So
hashtag free us, you know.
So yeah. Maybe I'm petty, but I do remember things.
She
like
did not
this.
Like us, you know. Like I've
with all of that said, I think she's gotten a bit of some unfair coverage.
Oh yeah,
people have suggested that she would just do whatever the prosecution wanted and refuse everything that the defense wanted.
That's so nonsense.
That's completely untrue. I'll give you one quick example that kind of relates to something we were just talking about. We were talking about his mental state. And the defense was saying at one point, his mental state was so awful when he was in Westville prison. When he finally got transferred to Cass County Jail, everything was great and he was in great mental health. As it happens, that's not true, because the prosecution was able to say, jury didn't get to hear this, but there is a tape of Mr. Allen in the Cass County Jail yelling and screaming and threatening the life of a guard. And at one point, he suggests he's going to slice that guard's throat and he draws a finger across his neck. And the prosecution says, this directly contradicts what the defense is telling us about his mental state. We want to put this into the trial. And Judge Gull said no. She found that would be prejudicial. So that's an example of her refusing a request from the prosecution to protect the defense. Mm-hmm. Right.
Gull kicked the defense attorneys at one point off the case after a catastrophic leak of pictures of these dead children. But after that, when the prosecutor tried to hold them in contempt for that leak, she actually ruled against even holding them in contempt because she said, like, you need more evidence for that and I'm not going to hold them in contempt. She let the defense at one point, like, you're not, like, this is shocking to me. Like, one of the defense attorneys is basically, like, DJing all these different clips of Allen being sad in prison and having a hard time in prison and struggling in prison. Normally, you wouldn't do that because you'd want the jury to be able to see the same thing the same time. But he's just skipping around where he wants them to go. And the prosecution kept objecting to that because they said, that's not fair. Like, how are we going to recreate that? Or how can we refute that if we can't recreate it? And she's basically just like, well, you know, whatever. Like, I mean, she gave them, I think, a wider berth than people think. I think some people think because she didn't let the Odinist theory in, that is why.
The claim that she didn't let them present a defense. First of all, it's not necessary for the defense to prove somebody else did it. You're just supposed to create a reasonable doubt. They wanted to present their Odinism theory. They did not get a chance to present that to the jury, but they did present that to the court, because prior to the trial, there was a 3-day hearing at which point the defense got the chance to prove that there was enough substance to this that it was worth presenting. What do I mean by that? It would not be fair if I was accused of a heinous crime, if I go and stand in the light of the world and say, it wasn't me, it was Bob Ruff. That wouldn't be fair unless there was some sort of evidence tying Bob Ruff to that crime. Otherwise, I'm smearing the name of an innocent person. Mm-hmm. Just to get out of it. Now, if there is evidence suggesting, well, maybe Bob Ruff had something to do with this, then maybe that's justified. So the purpose of this hearing was, is there any evidence tying these people to this crime? And the defense investigators couldn't even establish that some of these people were even in the city of Delphi, let alone at the crime scene when the murder happened. And if you can't even establish that a person was in the city, then there's clearly not enough reason to suggest that that person was the actual murderer. I think last week we talked about the defense theory that the girls were put into a car and driven away and then returned. And the whole reason for that is because one of their favorite suspects had an ironclad alibi for the time of the murder. And so in order to get around that, they had to have the murders actually taking place hours later. And so that's why they cooked up that theory. I think people who are rightfully concerned about wrongful convictions, you should also be concerned when defense attorneys or whoever are accusing other people and using evidence that you would find to be really unconvincing if otherwise.
I'm going to tell you this. I think the Odinism theory was satanic panic 2.0. I think the whole thing was it was bad. I mean, and it was like people being a pagan isn't a bad thing. Being a white supremacist is, and like certainly that side of Norse paganism is bad, but like just having different beliefs and being different in what you think. I mean, they were trying to stir this up. I mean, some of their filings were written like a bad pulp novel about like sacrifices and all this stuff. And we would talk to people who were either pagans or who study some of these white supremacist groups or study Norse paganism. And they were all telling us like what they're describing doesn't even make any sense. Even if you say that these guys are horrible white supremacists who are in some kind of weird Norse pagan cult, they're not going to sacrifice two white kids. Their whole thing is they want more white kids. I mean, they're white supremacists, for Christ's sake. You know, like, I feel like the defense was more concerned with that theory, with getting a lot of clicks, getting the social media side of things on their side and getting media attention. And they were successful in that. But it was a bad theory.
Well, it seemed like it was. And this is a perfect. We've got about 10 minutes or less. I think there was enough meat to it in the fact that, you know, we had there were a certain group of officers that had interviewed people. There were pieces of like the Frank's memo that were interesting to me, but the high, you know, it's, as I always say, my wife was just asking me some questions about the, what's the big trial that's going on right now? Everybody's talking about
at Lindsey Clancy.
Yeah. Yeah. The Lindsey Clancy, yeah, and all the theories going on about that one. And I told her the same thing as with this. It's never that complicated. It's never that complicated. And I don't know anything about that case other than just reading a little bit about it. But the last I wanted to bring up with you guys is one thing that has stuck with me, and I wonder, because you guys know so much and you've talked to so many people about the case. Reading through like the FBI's probable cause affidavit for the search for like Ron Logan's property, right? And there was a whole bunch of things there, like from an investigator standpoint, where I'm like, that's interesting. That's problematic. What, you know, all these things. And I've never been like, so Ron Logan did it, but I'm like, boy, that all sure looks like, I know they didn't find anything in the search, but that like makes him look like a really good suspect to me. And what I've never seen, and I'm curious if anyone is ever aware of this, and you know, I don't need you to really comment on whether, because I know you think Richard Allen did it and he didn't, as far as whether he's guilty or not, but have you seen, or does anything exist anywhere that shows us how or why or if the FBI ever cleared him as a suspect? Because it's like there's all this stuff, like he used his cousin to fabricate an alibi, and he was, you know, in blah blah blah, all these different, the phone pings, the guy on the bridge is a similar build to him, all these things. I'm like, so normally when I'm working on a case, then there's the document that says we investigated, and because of this, this, and this, he's cleared. And I've never seen that. So what I've always said is, if someone shows me how he was cleared, I'll get Ron Logan off my brain. Do you guys know how he was ever cleared, or if he ever was, or is it just like they must have cleared him because they weren't investigating him anymore?
So in our discussions with different investigators, not from this investigation, but from other investigations, and one comes to mind in particular, he tells us, you know, the way to clear somebody is to convict somebody else, that essentially police in some cases, especially high profile cases like this, might be reluctant to clear somebody and then learn more information later that makes them want to revisit that person or learn something that, okay, like there is a nexus there, that they're not in the business of necessarily. I know in this case, some of the girl's relatives went to police and were like, people are attacking us and they're saying we did this and you know we have an alibi. Can you please release a statement clearing us? And they would not, you know, like they, I don't think they were in the habit of documenting that. I think with Logan, that they had to look at him for the reasons you noted. You know, there's some stuff in there that I feel is overstated, like the phone coordinates we know to be a lot more inaccurate than what the FBI is indicating. But the FBI has a history of kind of overstating some of that stuff. That not finding anything, though, would mean that like there's nothing to really follow up there. I mean, if all they're getting is some people think he looks like the guy on the bridge and that he lied about something, which he had a reason to lie, which was that he was violating his parole. I mean, and I can tell you as a recovering alcoholic myself, like you know, when you're in that mode of like trying to drink and get away with stuff, you lie a lot. You know, you kind of lie as a second nature. To me, he doesn't sound like bridge guy, and he's too tall to be bridge guy. So like for me, like I think there was some suspicion in the beginning of like, yeah, we have to look at this guy, but is he really, like, what are we going to find? Maybe we'll find something and he's involved. Maybe we won't. I think they had to look at him. I think there's been stuff where people have said, like, he confessed in jail, right? That sounds pretty good, right? If he confessed to other inmates.
But when they jailhouse informant.
Right. But when they look at that, they look at that. The inmate's not even around him on the footage. Like there's no way he could have done that. Like there's just so much with Logan where it just goes nowhere.
And my understanding of the way this particular case worked is that sometimes investigators might mention to Prosecutor McClelland, oh, I think it's this guy or I think it's that guy. And his attitude was, okay, go and get me probable cause. So I'm not sure if it's a case where people just said, okay, let's stop working on Logan. I think some people believed it was Logan for a long time. I think it was an instance where they just never got enough probable cause that could lead to an arrest.
They got a probable cause for a search, obviously. And so I think that was appropriate. You know, I think they had to look at him. But I just think there was, if you don't find anything in that search, where can you go from there? I will say with Logan, it's often been portrayed as like the FBI. He was the FBI suspect. I think people need to remember the FBI is a huge organization. We were actually the ones who published that PCA and kind of, unfortunately, like there was a lot of firestorm around that. But I think, you know, there was an FBI man on Unified Command the whole time, like who eventually I think retired from the FBI, but like stayed on the investigation. So like the FBI is not unified and it's not one organization. It's that these investigators are throwing things at the wall to see what sticks. They've gotten some tips on this guy. There's some sketchy, you know, details about him. Let's look into him. But they had there were so many searches and suspects that they ran down that we don't have the documentation for, that we are aware of, but we just don't have that PCA. This was one of many. This was just the one that we happened to get our hands on and publish.
Yeah, with him, it's just one of those things where I would just, when I was reading the stuff that you guys have published and the different things that came in the case file, I'm like, I want to know more about him. Because these are all things that lead me to believe he's a suspect. And it's just like, there just isn't. And that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And I've always said, like, maybe exists somewhere or maybe there was a reason, whatever. But anyway, I was just curious if there was some document I was unaware of. But I know you guys only got a couple minutes.
Yeah, I'll just say, like, I think the evidence is what many of the investigators were compelled for. So if they find something for Alan, but not for Logan, they're going to go with Alan. And I think that's appropriate because I think when you're just looking at Logan, you're like, he's a drinking problem. He's kind of a mess. You know, I think that's how people get wrongfully convicted. It's like, this guy seems bad. Right. This guy seems more normal, you know, but I think you got to look, okay, who has the stack of evidence that's piling up versus somebody who may have just not be a great dude.
And I think that's part of my problem with it is confession aside, because I happened way later, but it was, there wasn't like this, like you said at the very beginning of last week, like there wasn't this like smoking gun obvious evidence that pointed at Richard Allen. It was like maybe some timeline stuff at that point and a bullet that maybe can't be excluded from, or that can't be excluded from his gun was it at that point, you know, or, you know, the timeline and the firearms evidence. So, but as you said, you guys have a hard out. We've got 2 minutes. Last quick question I'll ask you. I'm curious. I'm sure I know the answer to it, but I just want to make sure I ask you guys. Do you guys think that you could ever be convinced that Richard Allen is in that if some evidence came forward, do you think you could change your mind on it, or do you think there's just you're so certain that there's really nothing someone could show you that would change your mind?
I think you always have to be open to changing your mind. I would need someone to explain why Richard Allen knew about the white van, why Richard Allen's, you know, gun was able to produce, you know, rounds that were, you know, consistent with what was found at the scene, and why Richard Allen consistently placed himself in the same positions as Bridge Guy with these witnesses again and again without anyone seeing any other figures lurking around at those specific times. I think if someone could kind of go through all of that for me, knock those things down, I would need that in order to kind of feel like, okay, now I'm seeing a different picture. I find the totality of evidence extremely compelling. And it all adds up to this guy who we know to be a total like creep, you know, before this. I need that, you know, but I'm open. If something is able to kind of come down and bulldoze all that, sure. I mean, certainly would change my mind. Yeah.
And Kevin, you have had the least amount to say of all three of us earlier. So yeah, I'm going to give you the last word and we'll end on you.
Yeah, I'm always the quiet one. I agree with what Anya said. I also want to say to you, I really appreciate you giving us the time to come on, not only about this case, but about Temujin Kinzu. I know you and your audience have a very different point of view, and that's fine. I think I really give you a lot of kudos for letting the other side have its say and making sure your audience has all the information before they make their decision. And even if their decision is different from mine, I think their decision is better for having all of the evidence. And I really sincerely appreciate you giving us this opportunity and for giving us such a fair way to present our point of view. You've been great, and I appreciate it.
I concur.
Thank you guys for coming on. This has been great. I really appreciate it. And we're going to get you out 30 seconds early.
We did it. Go team.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21+.
Moto Casino.